She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Mrs. Green's World, a world where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and thanks for joining me. Just a quick shout-out to the sponsor of today's show, which is made possible due to the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group, doing their share, showing they care. We thank them for their support of Mrs. Green's World mission and vision, and for the many, many things they do every day to make our community and our world a better and more sustainable place. Thank you, Chapman. So the name of our show today is Food Security, a Global Challenge, and indeed it is. Joining us for this next hour to talk with us about that challenge is Jen Burney. She is assistant professor at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. And her full name is Jennifer Burney, but she does answer the phone, Jen. So I took that liberty, Jen. I hope that's okay with you.
That's perfect. Jennifer usually means I'm in trouble.
That's right. When somebody calls me Regina, I'm like, uh-oh, they don't know me very well, or my mother told them to call me that. And I really mean thanks for being with us. There's never a dull moment in Mrs. Green's World, and we spoke very, very briefly before the show. And I thanked you for all of the information that you have out there, for your radically rethinking food security, and for helping me shift the place from which I come, which a lot of times is I don't want to think because it doesn't feel really good, some of the things we're thinking about. So we're going to explore that today and share what you are doing, the important research, the work that you and your students are doing around the world in terms of innovative technologies and strategies. So are you ready for this?
Great. I'm excited to be here.
And I want to read a quote because I think it's a great foundation for the conversation we'll have. And it comes from the talk you gave to the Founders Symposium in San Diego in 2015, ever so relevant still. And it says, the world food system comprises hundreds of millions of farmers. And I always like to repeat, hundreds of millions of farmers. And sometimes I think of it as it's like three big ag companies that owns it all. It's like there's Monsanto and who else? Just kind of kidding. Making decisions in response to economic signals and environmental expectations. However, and this shocked me too, many of these farmers are food insecure by any number of metrics, and their production is threatened by anthropogenic climate change. Against this backdrop, what are the prospects for a world free from hunger? And you have a lot of answers to that. So I'd like to start, if you don't mind, with you kind of giving us the macro sense of what it means to be food insecure. What does the concept of food security mean?
Sure. I think maybe it's a little easier to say, you know, what it is when you are food secure. And that's having access to a stable and nutritious food supply, you know, for everything that you want to do to live an active and healthy life. And so a food secure world would be one in which everybody has that. You know, we know that's not the case right now.
In Tucson, Arizona, it's not the case, Jen.
Absolutely.
It's like one in four kids go to bed, they call it now food insecure, and I'm saying, why don't you just call it hungry? That's a really, it's a nice euphemism for, oh, they're food insecure. Well, that means you're going to bed not really fully satisfied.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you could think about food insecurity. I think the reason potentially we talk about food insecurity as sort of a bigger umbrella than maybe hunger is because you can be food insecure in a number of ways. I think we're used to thinking about just overall caloric insufficiency.
Right.
Right, just not getting, enough calories in your body. There are, a growing number of people in the world who get plenty of calories but don't get enough protein or don't get enough micronutrients, and they are also, you know, food insecure by this definition. Or there are people who most of the time have enough food but don't sometimes. And so that temporal instability, you know, would put you in this food insecure category as well. You know, speaking of kids in Tucson, right, that summer vacation is like a horrible time.
Yes.
For kids who no longer get meals through school, right? So
it really is. I mean, and we have been funding, you know, the backpack program where the kids that are in school have a backpack that they take home on Friday afternoon so that they have two more meals during the week, during the weekend. I mean, it's just, it really is in our own backyard, which is rather disheartening to me, since I had a 35-year career in social services before I was Mrs. Green. I'm like, what are we doing with hungry kids in a very affluent world called the United States of America? How many people in our world would you say suffer from food insecurity? Do you have a big number or a sense of how many people do suffer from food insecurity?
That's a very good question. You know, rough estimates, let's say, we think probably, you know, somewhere near a billion people.
It's
And then really there's a much bigger number that have these sort of more hidden forms of hunger, right? Where maybe, you know, it's not somebody who looks like they're wasting away, right? Not starving to death, but really nutritionally compromised.
Right, right.
Not getting enough protein, not getting enough micronutrients.
And I will bet somewhere in those numbers that are growing are elderly that live alone,
absolutely,
that are isolated, that really don't have enough food. I mean, our food delivery program is huge in this country, but it's hard to think that there might be a couple of neighbors living next door to you that don't have the means to either buy it or go out and get it. So I'm sure they're in those numbers too. Let's try to enter into a little bit about the really big piece of what you do and the relationship between food and climate. I mean, there's the obvious, it gets hot and crops burn, but you have a much more comprehensive look at that, and I'd love you to share with us the relationship between food and climate. That's what makes me sad and in trouble, but then I find Jen Burney, and I'm like, okay, there is hope.
Yeah, well, so I guess maybe I'll outline the sad part first.
That's good. I always like to start with the sad and then
then we'll go from despair to hope.
Yes. Love it.
That, you know, so I guess the sort of the sad reality now, right, is that that climate change already is making it harder to grow enough food. So we already have, you know, a billion-ish hungry people in the world, and it's getting harder to meet those needs. And at the same time, then just food production, processing, and consumption, right, you gotta cook food to eat it, that takes energy, that requires other inputs. That whole food system is also a major contributor to climate change. So right off the bat, we start with something that sounds like a really vicious cycle.
Right.
And I think that's where it's easy to throw up our hands and say, this is unsolvable. You know, but it turns out that a lot of the steps one could take to sort of build more climate resilient agriculture are also sort of mitigating future climate emissions. So there are some win-win solutions. And that's, I guess, we'll get to the hopeful part.
We'll get to the hopeful part, because I think a little bit in between, like the obvious question that came to me and was answered in my research is, you know, I'm always saying 40% of the food grown worldwide is wasted. 40% of the food grown worldwide is wasted. It could solve the hunger problem. So it begs the question, is part of the biggest part of the problem, or how big of part of the problem, is a food distribution problem? And if we solve that, can we be home free or at least moving in the right direction? What's your spin on that? And I have to admit, I do know the answer because I did my research, and I want you to share it with our listeners because they want to know too.
Great. So, I mean, I think one thing I'll say is that I think people do understand, right, that there are, maybe we'll step back for a second and say there are really two dimensions immediately to think about for food security, right? So the first is just the overall availability of food, right? Sort of how big the food supply is. And then the second is access, right?
Right.
Whether physical or economic. We know that we could produce enough food, but, you know, people may not have the economic or physical means to get those resources. And so I think there's a big understanding just, you know, interested people talking about this, that, that those two dimensions are important and they don't always line up. So, you know, I think that the important thing, though, is that they're not totally independent, right? So I think we often like to think about, particularly, you know, in the developed world context, we like to think about the world food supply almost like a big bathtub full of food.
Just right? waiting and, there to be distributed.
And we talk about it as though it's this sort of hand of God centralized distribution system that somehow puts this into everybody's
plate.
And all
of a sudden you're at Safeway or Whole Foods and it's all there. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's kind of not. Well, where does our food come from? You ask a kid and they say, Safeway.
Right. Right. And so then we talk about access issues, right, you know, as though somehow there were, you know, that we could make policy changes or, you know, dictatorial kind of changes, depending on how we want to think about it, and sort of move this stuff around, and that wouldn't actually impact the farmers who are producing this food, right? So we like to separate consumption and production, but they're actually not very separable in the real world.
Right.
And I think that's maybe a big takeaway from today.
I think it's a really big takeaway. I really do. And what about when you talk about the thing that kept hitting me is that I like to focus on big agribusinesses to help bring about food security. But what you talked about in the video that I watched and some of the research I read, the smallholders, the small farmers, how many are there and who are they? Why are they so important to focus on? That was three questions I realized, but they were. I can repeat them in rapid succession.
Good. You can interrupt me if I fail to answer one of those.
I'll be listening intently.
Okay, good. You know, so first, I guess, an interesting thing to think about is, you know, it's actually hard to count these numbers. We don't totally, you know, we don't know exactly how many farmers there are, but estimates are around like 600 million farmers.
I mean, that's
worldwide.
Unreal. 600 million farmers. So how do we go about impacting that, and where are they?
Right, so they're scattered everywhere, and when we think about, you know, sort of the breakdown in size, right, sort of maybe 100 million of those are really big,
right,
sort of when we think about like big commercial farms, and the majority of them, right, sort of 5-6 of them, the rest are smaller in what we'd call family farms, and if you look at different countries, right, the definition of what a family farm is, it varies.
Right.
You know, it varies in size. It varies around the world. But consider this like, you know, it's not a corporate entity. This is a family-owned agricultural business.
Right.
And, you know, so it, again, varies around the world. But typically at the in these family farms, right, families are, you know, they're producing food crops. But they're not subsistence. And by that I mean, for the most part, very few of those farmers are actually only consuming things they produce themselves.
Got it. And that was a really good point. It's not like they're just making, you know, growing crops, feeding their families, feeding neighboring communities, everything's great, and they sell the excess. Absolutely not true in many cases.
Yeah. Right. So even, I mean, and you know, even, right, think about like a very, you know, a sizable and successful farm, you know, someplace like the U.S., right? If you're a corn farmer, you're not only eating corn, right? You are,
hopefully.
You might keep some of it you know, but then you're selling it and then you're monetizing those goods and then you're going and you're buying other foodstuffs in the market, right?
Right, right.
And so that plays out all over the world, you know, in grocery stores, but also in like very little rural markets, right, where people are taking some of their cassava or yams or millet or whatever, and they're, you know, either selling it or trading it for protein, very, very important, right, like protein sources and micronutrient sources. So even the people in the world who are most dependent on agricultural production for their livelihoods, right, actually still need economic access to these other types of food,
right?
For food security. So it's really not so separable, the production and the consumption side, particularly when we think about the most vulnerable people. You know, so I think that's an important connection to draw out.
It's a huge part, and part of that picture that got painted for me when you talk about if I'm a farmer and I grow yams, and climate change, global warming, flooding, whatever, all of the things that climate change can bring about, it's destroys my crop. All of my power is gone. My ability to feed my family, use all that for bartering or exchanging to get other sources of food that I need. So it to me, it just adds to the big challenge of that food insecurity issue. So it's not a big distribution problem in that case. It's like this family can't eat because one season they got wiped out.
Right, absolutely. And I think you bring up an important point too, which you know, which is that most of these farmers, again, so some of them have irrigation, for example, you know, some of these smallholder farmers are growing, you know, sort of lowland flooded rice, sort of a different set of possible climate catastrophes there.
Right.
You know, so floods on the one end, but then I think, you know, a number of the very poorest family farmers are in very seasonal production system, so where all the rainfall is kind of confined to one part of the year and the rest of the year is dry, and so that's the production season. And like you say, if it's a drought or you know, if there's some sort of
or flooding,
you know, pest that sweeps yeah. through, or a flood
yeah, yeah.
or
whatever,
any kind
yeah.
of, you know, climate vulnerability, you know, not only do you have this sort of annual vulnerability, right, but that's on top of already this sort of seasonal vulnerability that's going on every year where, you know, you harvest, you have sort of the bit you keep for yourself, the stuff you sell, and then you're stretching that all the way through the year to the next harvest.
And a perfect example for me is like the rainforest where it just rains and rains and rains and then it doesn't. And then it really doesn't. So you have a really robust, full, lush growing season. And then nothing. Even in the desert, you know, people in the Southwest start counting the days till the monsoon comes, because it's scorched and it's awful and it's, you know, you can't grow a thing. Well, actually, you can, because there's some things that are very good to grow in the hot climate. But I mean, even here in Tucson, it is shocking to me how the weather and that whole seasonality really has an impact. You know, we're kind of getting into the area of your discussion, which was, it was really outstanding how climate impacts small farmers, and you actually broke it into three different impacts, and you mentioned one, so seasonality, where it's kind of a feast or famine mindset, right?
Right, absolutely. So yeah,
and you
everyone's
have
happy.
Yes, but you have hope for that, and we can talk about that before we go to break, and then we'll talk about some of the other ones when we come back. But seasonality, You gave me hope. And how are you involving women to help mitigate this one issue?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, if you think about the seasonality, let me just add one piece to that, which is the trouble also when you and all of your neighbors are in the same sort of climatic or agroclimatic system, right, is that, you know, harvest comes in and it comes in for you and you're really desperate to sell, but it's also come in for everybody else.
Yes.
And so you get these local price gluts. So this is like just insult to injury, right? You know, and so that dynamic is really rough, and this is sort of, we call it like the low productivity trap. And you could think about a lot of ways to break this, right? And I think there's great work being done, you know, on very creative ways to break this seasonal tie to rainfall. You know, so I have a, you know, some colleagues working on storage, right? How could you better manage crop storage so that people could not have to sell when prices are super low, or not have to sell everything when prices are super low, right? They could save some and sell it later on when prices are higher, things like that.
Right.
You know, and then the work that we're doing is really thinking about what role irrigation can play in enabling both year-round production and production of sort of higher value, you know, nutrient crops like fruits and vegetables.
Right. So that, and some of the things you're doing with women, and the video I saw, I kept running back on that. So you're actually, it's their seasonality, but you're extending the growing season by drip irrigation and other interventions is what I call them, that you're putting in to help mitigate that. So we're going to have to take our first break. I told you the time would fly. It's like that was 20 minutes. And I always like, when I get so caught up that I'm getting the 2-minute warning, everybody will be right back. There's lots more to talk about, to totally think about really a radical rethinking of climate change and food insecurity. More from Jen Burney when we come back. Longer trends, air pollution, we're going to cover it all. Stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being with us. Joining me for this hour is Jennifer Burney. She is the assistant professor at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. Jen is an environmental scientist whose research focuses on simultaneously achieving global food security and mitigating climate change. And I want to make sure that in this discussion, Jen, that I get to that question of how, when you start to achieve global food security, I so clearly understand why it does mitigate climate change and why we've got to hurry up and get there. Much of Jen's research focuses on the developing world, and she is particularly interested in the science, technology, and policy of short-lived climate pollutants, or as you lovingly refer to them in one of your pieces, SLCPs, and the role that mitigation of these compounds can play in meeting both climate and food security objectives. Such fascinating work that you're doing. And Jen, just going back a little bit, what got you interested in this as a field of study? And it is revolutionary thinking. You are asking for radical change, and it's so important and doable. It's not like you're reaching for some obscure solution. I kept looking at these videos and saying, this is so doable. It gave me hope.
I'm very happy to hear that.
So tell me what got you excited about this and made it be a field of study when there's a vast array of things to study about with climate change?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, I my background is in physics, so that's sort of fundamentally how I look at the world. And I think there's this very interesting sort of systems level question when you have, right, hundreds of millions of agents making decisions and thinking about, what to plant and what's going to happen and what are the signals going to be like. I think it's sort of a really nice, a complex systems kind of question, but then also, I like to travel and I really sort of like to be out in remote places and sort of hear how things are going. And, you know, one thing you know when you travel anywhere, right, it's like food is so central in every culture. Obviously, everybody needs it daily. That goes without saying. But, you know, right, it's sort of a central thing. And, it's something that people talk about. And it's obviously like I guess it's just cross-cutting around the world.
And it's a major piece of, it's the way we define our cultures. So much of our culture is defined by the food we eat and around eating and special occasions and all of that. So going back to, and it's interesting to me because you really are so interested in the science of it and some of the remote places that you talk about that you're doing research, I was thinking, I think I would like to go if there was an RV with me. I'm not sure. That was the terrible honest thought. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't want to go there.
Look, if you can survive Tucson this summer, you can be anywhere in the
That's
world.
That's true, but I'm sitting in an air-conditioned studio, you know what I mean, where it's like the air's blowing on me and everybody just whines about it so much. But anyway, so when you're talking about alleviating constraints, that climate places on these small farmers. And let's again reiterate, there are millions of them. You said 500 to 600 million of them. So how do we help impact all of the small contributions that they make? And you talked about seasonality, so the feast or famine mindset and how to get it more profitable and mitigating climate change. And, you know, expand on that a little bit, because if you extend the growing cycle, there's more, all of the things. The ground is cooler, oxygen is being produced, so it helps everybody, including us in the air we breathe, correct? Spoken as a true non-scientist on my part.
Yep, we do like more plants in the ground, absolutely.
Yeah, and it matters.
It does matter. And I think, you know, maybe the way to think about, one way to think about it is to sort of flip that on its head and say, right, if you are a farmer and you're noticing that, you know, over the past decade or two, right, the trend has not been as good as you would like, right, or as good as you would think for, you know, investing in new technology. Maybe you've got more fertilizer, you're using, you know, a tractor, whatever, right? Sort of imagine you're a small farmer in a resource-constrained context, right? If you're noticing this trend and you're noticing that either your yields aren't going up as much as they should or they're going down over time, right, you sort of have two choices, right? You can think about things that you might do to sort of boost your productivity on the land you have, or you can think about expanding your land footprint.
Got it.
Right? So two margins.
Yes.
The economists will call them the intensive and extensive margins.
Right.
So you can intensify or you can extensify. And, you know, one of the things we see when we talk about the climate impact of food production, the biggest piece of that by far is in extensification of cropland. So just more native habitats being converted to crop and pasture land, right? That just releases a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Right? So all that carbon that's stored in trees and plants and sort of some of the stuff in the soil, right, in pretty short time scale when those trees are cut down, that mostly gets burned within a few years and ends up in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So that's a really big piece to this. And I think, you know, in the developed world context, we think about big ag and we say, intensive agriculture is, it uses a lot of fertilizer, it uses a lot of machinery, it uses a lot of energy to pump water for irrigation, right? That's got to be super bad for the climate, right?
Right.
And it's like those things do, you know, emit greenhouse gases that do cause warming, obviously. But the sort of counterfactual to that, which is, okay, so say you didn't intensify, say you just extensified to produce the same amount of food, right? That footprint would be so much bigger. There's so much more carbon stored in native habitats that we don't want converted to cropland if we want to think about sort of a climate stable world. So, you know, it turns out that intensification is like a much better climate strategy, right? If you were going to think only about climate. But intensification is also, right, what farmers would want. They want, more productivity out of their existing land. They don't want to have to buy new land. They don't want to have to, you know, farm more land at that lower level of productivity. So this is one of those like nice win-win synergies. Sort of boosting yields and productivity is really good on both fronts.
So basically what you're saying is, and I'm listening intently, so these longer trends where it gets warmer and there's smaller yields, if we could focus on increasing the yields, not increasing the amount of land that we use to grow the crops, this is the way to have the most major impact on climate change in this particular scenario.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. I wanted to make sure that I got that. And, I think that another shocker for me in the past couple of months has been there is that really, truly impressive number of negative number because of the deforestation and the expansion of pasture land. I mean, methane gas, big problem, folks. Really big problem to make land for room for all those cows and cutting down trees in the rainforest. We've already done 20%. So it's really So I get it. What you're suggesting is really to, I get it. It's warmer. We have smaller yields. Let's have bigger yields and not necessarily expand the way that we're the area we're growing. Destroy more. Okay, I got it. Now, a longer discussion is, and I want to try to go through this step by step because I think it's very important when you talk about air pollution and the potent climate change agents that impact people and food. I mean, there's a whole cycle there that when you were to write about anthropogenic climate change, it explains the difference to me between what the climate deniers call normal cycles and the role humans play. I mean, this is really one of the ways where I think the research and the science of it addresses why air pollution is caused by humans and the machines and the this and the that and the other thing, and it is hurting us. So can you have plenty of time to talk about these steps, and I will interject with some of my questions if I get lost, because it's like this is for, you know, not people working with the science every day, but all of it made sense to me.
Yeah, sure. I think, I have to say, I never actually thought about it in that way, but you're totally right, right? You know, like there is the detection and attribution when we talk about climate change and anthropogenic influence, right? What we're doing is connecting the dots between emissions of long-lived greenhouse gases, and carbon dioxide is the biggest, most important one, right? So like CO2 emissions and then, you know, rising temperatures.
Right.
And then all the subsequent, the cascade of stuff that flows from that, like sea level rise and so on. So, you know, there's this small and usually smaller with every passing day, but group of climate skeptics that sort of say, you know, this is not statistically sound enough yet. Right.
To say, I don't ever have them on the show. I'm sorry.
But in some ways, right, the whatever it is that they use to make that argument, right, about carbon dioxide, because what we're talking about are small changes in the amount of carbon dioxide. Well, relatively speaking, small changes of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You know, that's what they use to say, well, that's part of their fuel, their
right.
ammunition, I guess.
Right.
But when we think about things that we conventionally consider air pollutants, right? So thinking particulate matter, things like NOx from tailpipes, tailpipe emissions, right? Ozone precursors, you know, that make sort of surface level ozone.
Which right.
is, you know, we got ozone way high up in the stratosphere is great. Ozone down at the surface is terrible. You know, everybody who has asthma, like me, suffers.
Yes, knows that just from the air you breathe. It's out
yes.
there. Yes, yes.
And this detection and attribution problem is very, very easy. Like you say, it's like nobody has a question about the fact that cars are producing air pollutants. Right. And in some ways, for so long, air quality was not actually considered a climate issue.
Right.
Right. It's really been in the last, really two decades that the science around the climate impacts of this set of compounds that we conventionally consider pollutants. Right. We have learned about their actual longer run larger scale climate impacts, you know, so there's this connection that I think in some ways, right, air pollution wasn't politically toxic in the same way that climate was.
Right, right. right.
But now, you know,
Wake
we know
up,
that
folks.
They're deep,
yeah.
Now we know that they're deeply linked and a lot of these, well, they're complicated, right? So when we think about air pollutants, it's a big, you know, proverbial basket of different compounds that behave very differently in the atmosphere. One of the things that sets them apart from things like carbon dioxide is that they tend to have shorter atmospheric lifetimes. So hence that horrible acronym that you referred to earlier, right? Short-lived climate pollutants.
Yeah.
That's sort of one defining feature that sets them apart. So a lot of these actually do have warming effects. Some actually have cooling effects. Almost all of them have detrimental human health effects.
Yeah, I mean,
so
really.
Yeah, so this has been a real, and there's been a lot of focus on this recently as sort of a win-win way to get in to climate, right? To sort of look at the co-benefits, as we would call them, right, that would come from cleaning up the air, and to use that to motivate this action, right? So there's really significant human impact if you clean up air quality, right? People are healthier, they live longer, you're avoiding millions of premature deaths every year. And not only that, it's good for climate.
Right.
So it's been sort of a backdoor entry to the climate discussion, I think, more and more lately.
And then some of the causes, like in the research that I did, I know I picked this quote up that it says 40% of current warming is actually the result of short-lived compounds. And once again, the shift in my thinking, it's like, wow, 40% is a big number, being the air, polluting the air with things like black carbon, which is soot from stoves, right? Is it mostly from stoves? And then what about
and from diesel?
And what?
And from diesel and coal combustion, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And tropospheric surface ozone. I'm not sure what that is.
So, yeah, just ozone at the surface level as opposed to, again, we like it up in the stratosphere. We don't like it down in the troposphere because it makes us really sick.
Right. And asthma and all of those things. But this is where I'd like you to go through an example. And so there are people, millions of people, that gather dung, they gather food scraps, they gather whatever they can to make their fires, to cook their food on. So is this one of the black carbons that you're talking about? Or is that too much of a generalization and a leap on the part of this consumer?
No, you're absolutely right. So, you know, again, it's always hard to get an absolute number, but globally we think something like, you know, 2 or 3 billion people are probably up more towards 3 billion, but are cooking using...
3 billion, that's a big number again. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, it's huge, like half the world.
It's huge.
So, using, you know, unprocessed, just solid fuels, things like crop residues, things like...
Like, what is a crop residue?
So, like, imagine a cornfield, right?
Right.
And you harvest all the corn, and then at the end of the season,
everything that's left
starts to dry out, right?
Okay, yep.
And what do you do with that, right? A lot of times, it just sort of gets plowed under, right? Keep that carbon there. But it's also biomass that can be burned for heat, right?
Okay, yes.
So, things like wood, you know, wood... small wood fuels, right? People go cut small branches and gather wood, or crop residues, or things like dung, as you know, essentially free, because they're not monetized, right? It's
right.
The labor to go collect them, fuel for cooking and heating. And they're burning this stuff in usually in a sort of traditional kind of mud hearths, right? You know, sort of like basic cooking technology, right? You put a fire, a few rocks, balance a pot over the rocks, right?
Exactly. We call it camping in our country, and it's a recreational opportunity, and we have
camping, exactly.
We have charcoal briquettes. This is not the same thing. I mean, it's so...
But it's the same kind of fire, right?
Yes.
And you know what you smell like, and you know how your throat feels the next morning.
And everything that you touch, it's on everything. And you have to, you know...
Yeah. And so these fires, you know, like, again, I'm the physics dork of it, right? They tend to be very oxygen-poor combustion conditions.
Uh-huh.
So all the carbon that's in that biomass or in, you know, in the wood or in the crop residue or in the dung, right, a lot of that is just partially combusted. So some of it is converted to carbon dioxide, but then you get these products of incomplete combustion, and that's things like, you know, black carbon, particulate matter, other stuff that, you know, has sort of detrimental impacts.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I just sit here and think it's such a vicious cycle. Is here are these farmers that are working in less than satisfactory conditions from where I sit and struggling so hard to literally survive every day. And the gathering of the fuel is another thing that they have to do. So, of course, they're going to use anything that is within reach. They're not going to the corner.
Yeah.
I know. And you know, believe it or not, we have to take another break. It's right in the middle of everything. And when we come back, I would like to talk to you about cook stoves. Are they one of the answers to cutting down on pollution? Like if we did this big drive and got everybody to have cook stoves, would that help? And if not, how do we impact those levels? That's one. What kinds of impact can it have? And how quickly will we be able to measure the impact? Because I think those are the part of the hope answers that I found in doing the research to prepare for the show. Everybody, stay here with me. We're learning so much about our food system and food security, food insecurity, and how we radically change that. We'll be right back. More with Jen Burney.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being with us. I'm sure you're enjoying it as much as I am. The name of our show today is Food Security, a Global Challenge. And joining us for this hour to talk about with us about the many complexities of this truly global challenge, folks. It's impacting us all, even if you might not be able to feel the impact right now. It's just around the corner. Jen Burney is the assistant professor at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego, and she is an environmental scientist whose research focuses on simultaneously on achieving global food security and mitigating climate change. It's such a good marriage, Jen. I mean, it really is. And you tie it all together in such an understandable way, which really matters to me. It just makes common sense. So let's talk about cook stove. Are they the answers? Is that a great answer? Let's go buy everybody cook stoves.
They are an answer.
Okay.
For sure. I mean, I guess we should go back to one thing, which somehow I realized during the break that we hadn't yet said, but I think you and I both assumed. One thing that's worth mentioning is that these air pollutants, these short-lived climate pollutants, we know that they have very detrimental human health impacts, but they're also really bad for crops. So ozone
right.
is terrible
Oh,
for
right.
crops.
I'm so glad you brought that up. It's not just hurting our lungs. It's hurting the food we're eating.
Yeah, and forests, and you know,
right,
so,
right.
So again, that's one of those places where we say, like, look, you know, this could be win-win. Yeah, so cook stoves, right? I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, I think probably your listeners of all ages will have heard about clean cook stoves at some point, right?
Yes.
This is nothing new, especially from like the public health perspective, right?
Right.
So there's been,
right.
four decades of cook stove projects in mostly developing communities, right? And four decades worth of work has not catalyzed some grand uptake of of new technologies, right? Which is
so true.
I don't mean to depress everybody, but
it's so true.
But it's true, right? So we're talking about, you know, 3 billion people still cooking like this. And so the question is why, right? You know, and I think there's a bunch of whys, there's a bunch of answers there. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I think two things we know are true, and we've been sort of doing some research to look at this. The first is that, you know, people talk about improved cook stoves, and what is labeled an improved cook stove is often actually no better than a traditional cook stove when you look at its emissions profiles.
Yes.
So this is just a bummer.
It is just a bummer. You're right. It's like, oh my gosh, no. Okay.
You know, the other thing that we've, you know, there's some unfortunate things that that happen too sometimes, right? Which is a lot of cook stove projects have focused on putting chimneys on cook stoves, right? And that's actually really good for the people who tend to be stuck right by the stove.
Sitting
in particular,
right there,
like,
yes.
Like usually the woman cooking,
right.
and even more important, like the little babies who can't move.
That are sitting right there, yes.
Yeah, that are just there, or the kids in the kitchen. But when you put a chimney on a stove, often what you do is you just take all that and that pollution, you just dump it right outside the house, right? And so if people are getting high ambient exposures just kind of locally next to the house too, right, you don't get as much of a health improvement as you would expect. So there's a lot of stuff like this, both just the technology's not actually being that much better overall, that the technologies that have been sort of tested or used in these projects. At the same time, I mean, there is hope. There are some good, there are some very good, you know, biomass burning stoves, right? So same fuel, you don't have to change the fuel people are using. And the best of these are really stoves that have like a little, you can imagine this, right? You've built a campfire,
right.
You know what this is like, you're sitting there blowing on it, right? You want more oxygen going through it,
yes.
Right? And these are the best of these cook stoves are like that. They're a cook stove, and then they take some of that residual heat and they use it to charge a little battery that runs a fan.
Got it.
And that fan drives air into the cook stove, right?
Right.
And that makes the burning much cleaner, right? All that carbon's getting combusted into carbon dioxide, not particulates, not all the stuff that you're going to inhale and
make you sicker.
And it's going to make you really sick. Yeah. So those are really good, and those actually do make, bring the emissions levels down to places where we'd rather have them. But they're more expensive. Right. And I think that is an unfortunate reality that I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out how to deal with. Right. So there's a lot of projects you can imagine. Right. You say, oh, cook stoves, it's a great idea. Let's get an improved cook stove. What's the cheapest improved cook stove on the market? Because then we can buy more of them. Right.
Yes,
and
yes.
And
yep.
They turn out to just not be that good. So they are more expensive. These are typically units that cost more, like $70, $80, $100 than $10 or $15.
Which can be a year's wages, and I'm barely kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, it's maybe that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but in some cases not.
It's important, right? And so when you think about, I think there's a lot of really interesting work. So I'm not a financial expert, but there is a lot of really interesting work in thinking about how to both use financial tools that are already out there, things like loans for cook stoves, right? Special,
right.
Like loan or
micro-loans.
Credit packages for this kind of thing. Or even being able to connect individual consumers to things like carbon markets,
right?
Where you're getting a credit, now with things like, mobile money, you can transfer this directly to somebody's cell phone. The cell phone both connects to the stove and tells you that the stove is being used. Tells the market that the stove is being used, and the market can then just transfer credit directly to the phone. This is the brave new world that's coming, right? It's awesome.
It's hopeful.
Yeah, so then these households can get these carbon credits, right? And you have this sort of win-win-win thing going on. So there's work to figure out. There's a lot of intricacies in that. One of the big ones is when if you think about a carbon market, that's paying people to not emit as much as they otherwise would have, right? So you buy this cook stove and it knocks down your emissions from what they would have been. We need to make sure that calculation is actually correct. And moreover, we would like that calculation to take into account things like the short-lived climate pollutants, not just carbon dioxide, right? And so figuring out exactly how you get it such that you're really paying people to clean up, like for cleaner technologies, then I think that's an incredibly powerful idea. And I think it's going to work.
And that makes me so hopeful. And the other thing is, you talk about the price of a cleaner burning cook stove, and then you think about the price of one tractor to expand the land and expand the cropland. One tractor could buy a whole heck of a lot of cook stoves, which would then create, help mitigate the pollution, which would then help the yields increase ostensibly, and you have a cycle, a healthy cycle, as opposed to one that just keeps feeding itself, and result is millions of starving people or food insecure people. It's a really good example. Can you tell us, Jen, I'd love you to tell us one story of some of the work you and your students are doing that does give you hope, and where is that, that you're finding things? Are you working in Brazil? Are you working in India? Where are you focusing some of your research, and what is that?
Yeah, sure. Let me tell you a story about Brazil, just because my head's been thinking about this project the past few days. So in Northeast Brazil, we're used to thinking about Brazil as this very lush green place. You're either thinking of like the Cerrado, or you're thinking of the rainforest, right? And so Brazil actually has a semi-arid region that looks a lot more like the Southwest U.S.
In which case, it's probably burning right now. I'm only kidding. There's six forest fires in California as we speak. So, climate change.
Yes, indeed. There's a semi-arid region in Brazil, and it sort of overlaps with a key dairy production region. So, cows for milk. And this is, again, a lot of family farmers. So not big agro-industrial operations, but rather, families with pretty small herds producing milk, getting that milk to both sort of local villages, having some, maybe making cheese, whatever, connecting to sort of markets on a low scale.
Right.
And this is another example of this sort of low productivity cycle that we spoke about earlier, only with livestock, right? So livestock need a couple of things. They need to have enough calories, they need to have protein, and they also just need roughage, right?
Right.
And so if you think about the volume of grazing material that's produced every year, just like with crops, that's a direct function of rainfall. And so in a bad year, not only do, food crops for humans suffer, but food crops for animals suffer.
Right.
And, when we think about livestock in the developing world or in sort of developing communities, livestock play a different role than they do, for your average, I guess, whole foods consumer who's thinking about eating less meat, right, to be better for the planet.
Yes.
So there's sort of two different livestock worlds out there. And in this other world, right, livestock are not only your source of income on a year-to-year basis, either through milk or because you're slaughtering some animals every year, but livestock are also your assets, right?
Right.
It's a huge portion of the value, the economic value that your household has.
Huge.
And so you get this double hit in a bad year, right? That not only might your income go down, right, if it's hot and dry and there's not enough food, your cows aren't going to make much milk. Think about a dairy farmer here. But also, if it's really bad and your cows might die, then you're taking this deep, deep hit, right?
Right.
We think about farmers, farmers understand more than anyone the importance of a robust and healthy ecosystem, right?
Yeah, and that that fragile balance.
Yeah, better than anyone. There's nobody whose livelihoods are more directly and consciously tied to the environment than farmers.
Than farmers. Could not agree with you more.
And yet, right, in a bad year, if you're a dairy farmer in a dry area like Northeast Brazil or in the Sahel somewhere, right, if it's a bad year, you have a terrible choice, right? You know that you want to maintain
yes.
your healthy forage production, but are you going to, let your entire herd suffer or die and all the catastrophic long-run economic consequences that come with that? No, you're going to take a risk on it, right?
Right.
You're either going to let them eat or you're going to expand your cropland. You're going to do whatever you can to keep them alive. And so what we see in these regions is a really tough, connection between climate shocks and then really ecosystem degradation, which of course then feeds into more climate impacts if people have to expand their cropland or pasture land. So one of the things we're thinking about is how to make more intensive forage production. So working with a group called Adapta Sertao in Northeast Brazil to test some really unique solutions. So one of the things that turns out to be kind of humorous and awesome is that these dairy cows really like, you're from Tucson, so, nopales, right? So
right.
like cactus. cactus. And cactus are obviously great in desert environments, arid and semi-arid environments. They grow like bonkers, and you can crunch them up into sort of a really nice seed.
Indestructible.
For livestock, yeah.
They have to be.
You can't get rid of them if you want to.
Heck
yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And they're a really good feed, so it turns out you can really bust this cycle, right? You can make, you can just change completely the way a small livestock farm operates, because suddenly they can produce way more forage on their land, and they can at the same time sort of rehabilitate the ecosystem of their farm, reduce the risk that you expand your cropland, things like this. So that's been a very fun project to be involved
and
with.
That's and that's for, yeah, that's, and I see it, and it impacts climate, and it's the healthier cycle all around, helps food production, helps with consumption. We have 5 minutes left, and I want to get into a whole nother area, but I know you can
right,
answer it.
Go.
Because there was something I wanted to, let's finish that, because, you know, the whirling dervish brain kicks in occasionally. So in this area in Brazil, the part of research you're doing is it teaching the people there that this is a good thing for forage, that they are having cactus for dinner, is the way I would put it? Let's give the cows cactus for dinner. Was it that simple?
Yeah, so it's actually a really interesting, it's a really interesting collaboration. So Brazil has their version of like the USDA, right, our Department
right.
of Agriculture. It's called Embrapa, and they're a tremendously wonderful, you know, very top-notch scientific research institution, right? So
okay.
they've done a lot of work on what could you grow, right? Like, just like we would here think about going to the USDA as a resource, right?
Right.
That's like an international resource with tons of field research on what kinds of crops grow, you know, could they be used as feed, et cetera. So they've got this sort of core group of research. The group that's really implementing the work is a local Brazilian NGO, and they're sort of taking this
awesome.
Research and training farmers, right, working with farmer
yes.
co-ops, that happens
right.
to be just the organizing principle there,
right.
To run, it looks like extension services, right, in some ways. So very... you've got technicians going out, they've got a group of farmers they're working with them month on month and sort of helping carry them through this process, right? And then what we're doing on our end is really setting up the research design so you can measure this impact, so we're actually
right.
able to assess that this does do better. This gets the impacts that you want. Yields go up for milk, right? Landscapes look better. You're actually rehabilitating the ecosystem. We're looking at farm-level profitability, right, and sort of how that scales up.
It's the whole enchilada. I mean, it really is. It's a very...
A whole Nopales enchilada,
yes. It is. It's like a very integrated approach involving many partners, and it's another thing that gave me hope. And, you know, I don't think we have enough time to get into this third topic, but I wanted to talk to you about... I was very intrigued by the whole concept, which is a field of study for you, about energy poverty and the lack of access to modern energy services and how that impacts poverty and food production and consumption. And if you can answer that in 1 minute, great, but I don't think you can. We have 2 minutes left, so I'll have to have you back.
Sounds good. Maybe I'll just say that you can flip this whole thing on its head and say, right, that if you think about like another way to break this cycle of food productivity being tied to rainfall is to think about using irrigation.
Got it.
The limiting factor for irrigation is sort of the energy to move the water. It's similar to the cook stoves, right? These sort of unimproved cook stoves are a very low form of energy, right? That is a form of energy poverty, being reliant on going to gather your fuel for all your cooking and heating needs. So,
Jen, that is a great answer, and you synthesized it so easily. I mean, it just crystallized it for me. So, yeah.
All right, I'm glad.
Irrigation is great, but you have to have energy to provide the irrigation, and then the cycle changes and shifts, and we're going in a more positive direction. It was awesome. And before we get off the air, I just want to tell you a quick little story. When I started doing the research, I called Kelly, our show producer, and I said, Kel, how do we find Jen Burney? She read about you on a magazine on the airline. Not kidding. And she brought it, and she's the show producer, and she went over it with me, and I'm like, how do you find, I mean, this has been a great show, Jen. I've learned a lot. It gave me hope, and I hope we stay connected. I appreciate the work you're doing, and so will our thousands of listeners. So thanks for taking the time. Everybody, Jen Burney, you can just Google her, and she comes up. Jennifer Burney, B-U-R-N-E-Y. Make it a great green week, everybody. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And Jen Burney, thanks for showing up in our world.
Thank you for having me.